Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... Welcome to the fourth episode of New Scientist, 1st of December 2018. This is trialling a new software thing where I can actually read the article. So I've just read it, but it's coming up. And having read it, I can actually tell you what I'm going to tell you about. So the first article is Into the Dark, which is a rather flaky article about dark matter. And it really tells you, you have to really dig into it to tell you that supersymmetry is dead and the LHC has really found nothing. This is after the Higgs boson. They found absolutely nothing nowhere. It's really rather boring, and they're desperately hoping to find other particles. The next article is The Missing City on the Plains, which is a group of gung-ho US people who are absolutely sure they found a second city, and they probably have. It's just interesting about how these cities form and how they're stalled. Going forward, there's a good book on living hive life. It is interesting listening to that because you find out that the bees are no good at their waggle dance and give bees actually a scent clue. So the general waggle dance, but it's the scent clue and other information there. Then there's a really fantastic set of brilliant letters coming across. I just can't find something. There's Elon's satellite garbage, which is, I think, the Polynesians who use knots as well. It's quite interesting. There's really nothing really of interest there. Then there's a big talk about why do lighter skiers work? And I think a poor Australian correspondent got, I think, absolutely wrong in his first answer. There's a interesting article on about how t-shirts lose their shape. Again, that does my head in. And then finally, there's an article about beer guts. And unfortunately, the respondent misses the fact that a beer gut, your typical beer gut, is from an inflamed liver on the way out. Hope everything goes well, and we'll go on the software to see whether this actually pops in front rather at the end, if I've put everything right. Thanks a lot for listening. New Scientist, 1st of September 2018, Episode 4, Into the Dark, Dark Matter Particles Secretly Crossing to the Regular World Could Open Portals to the Universe's Hidden Realm, found Daniel Cousins. So, this is a dark matter. Firstly, they believe that dark matter is in particles, which is a sort of a bizarre view anyway, but it could secretly cross into our real world, and secretly means, very hard to detect. It sounds like crystal healing. It's pretty bizarro in all levels. Look, there may actually be something to it here. We know it's out there. It makes up the bulk of matter in the universe and sculpts its grandest features with a hidden gravitational hand. So what how they deduce there's dark matter in the universe is anomalous gravity operating at galactic scales. This means that gravity is completely fine within our solar system, meaning either that there is no dark matter or there is a uniform dark matter. So we're actually immersed in a uniform sea of dark matter. Either of those two can happen. If we have, say, a dark matter gradient, we'd have a gravitational field gradient. And that, I think, could be enough to kickstart some pretty amazing things. I think in gravitational models, that could be the hidden ingredient which would explain some amazing things like solar system rearrangement. So I think there's a possibility out there. But as far as we can see, it is that we can't detect any dark matter within the range of the solar system. So there's no more dark matter is not being pulled in towards the sun, and there's sort of a range. There's no matter that can't be actually accounted for in our solar system. However, go up to galactic scales, it's as if dark matter has set our galaxy in jello. gelatine, you know, those 1970s or 60s desserts where they put fruit in gelatine and served up to you. It's sort of floating in them. So rather than things bouncing about the place, they tend to actually not mix. The galaxies aren't, our galaxy isn't mixing fast enough. Other galaxies, there's apparent unusual motion. So there's several things here. But let's get back to it. And yet, this is only the second sentence, and yet I'm just looking for, oh yes, there's a quote in the third paragraph, absolutely full on. So if you look in, and where does the quote come from? Let's listen to it. The second sentence. And yet, despite a long campaign to expose it, the mysterious cosmic architect known as dark matter continues to evade detection. So very beautiful prose in there, however, very complex to understand. Beautifully written. Myriad dark matter hunters have spent decades trying to trap their prime suspect. Beautiful English, but very dense. They may yet prevail, but their struggle has led a new wave of hunters to try a different approach. Rather than tailing their search for a single candidate, they are embracing the possibility that dark matter consists of a panoply of particle armed forces, an entire dark sector operating in parallel to our own. Okay, so I would find this is great English if you know, but if you don't know what dark matter is, you find this would be impenetrable to get through. This hidden realm would be accessible by only the faintest lines of communication. So particles cable carrying messages from the dark side of the world to the world of familiar matter. Dear. Now, the plan is to track those go-betweens as they pass messages through these dark portals, wiretapping them to learn about the universe on the other side. Quote, "This is a shift in the way we think about the problem," says Jonathan Feng, theorist at the University of California, Irvine. Quote, it has reinvigorated the search. That is, dark matter. You set up an experiment which you know is not going to work. And that's probably a dark matter experiment. So if you have an experiment, that's a complete waste of time. Well, it was a dark matter experiment. Okay. All we know about dark matter comes from the way stars at the outer reach of the galaxies move faster than expected, given the amount of visible mass present. So fast, in fact, that the galaxies should have long since been torn apart. Well, that's one aspect. It's spinning too fast, too wild. This is hidden glue. For some physicists, this is the reason enough to believe Einstein's laws of gravity are wrong. Others insist that some invisible form of matter must be lurking behind the scenes, holding the universe together. That's dark matter they're talking about. Pitiful WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, a WIMP. For decades, the prime suspect has been the weakly interactive massive particle, or WIMP. Sorry if it's like that. The hypothetical heavy particle is attractive thanks to a remarkable coincidence, the WIMP miracle. When physicists calculate how many of them would have survived from the early universe to the present day, they get exactly the amount of dark matter we need to explain our observation. Okay, well, thank you for calculating that. The other thing in their favour is that WIMP-like particles emerge naturally from supersymmetry, a mathematically elegant theory designed to smooth over the wrinkles in the standard models. Our best picture of particles and their interactions. Okay, so the standard model is your leptons, which is your neutrinos and electrons, and quarks, which is your up and down quark, those two generations. So there's four types of, two groups, quarks and leptons. And in each of those groups are two, so that's 2 times 2 is 4, and there's 3 generations, which are 12. Then you've got gauge particles, which are 3 gauge particles plus a, a vector boson, which is the Higgs that gives you the simple stuff. But then people have been playing around to try and get it with this thing called supersymmetry. So, supersymmetry, I think, is dead because it hasn't come up with it predicts, but in making the prediction, it predicts additional particles which haven't been seen. So I think supersymmetry has got a bit of a problem, but supersymmetry also produces WIMPs. So each... well, are particles. So you've got a photon, which is a gauge boson. Yeah, okay, photons are bosons. So bosons have spin zero, whereas the quarks and leptons have spin a half. So they're gauge bosons. They're force-carrying particles, I'd say, in inverted commas. So, like, the boson is a particle associated with it from the Higgs field. Let's try and move on here. Sorry about this. All told, WIMPs looked to be such a hot suspect that it was merely a matter of smoking them out. In a boon to experimentalists, they predicted that WIMPs would, in addition to pulling gravity, feel the weak nuclear force, which is beefier, not only works across tiny distances. Oh, okay. And only works across tiny distances. Yeah, this is the weak force. This is beta decay. This makes them capable of interacting with regular matter in experiments and sparked a worldwide race to find them. And yet, there is no sign of them, nor are the indications of any of the heavy partners known as that supersymmetry predicts. This is what I was saying, that the CERN super collider, the biggest experiment, sort of dwarfs the Lunar project in terms of expense and price and, you know, numbers of scientists, man years, just there. And it's produced one result, which is the Higgs boson, and nothing else. There is nothing there. There's no supersymmetry, is there? This is the big story. There is, move along now, physics is dead. After years and years of, turn it up, whoa, I just switched on my machine, got all this information, LIGO is great and all this type of stuff. The CERN is just eerily quiet. They might show up, of course, but our most promising candidate is running out of places to hide, just as its theoretical underpinnings are looking shaky, and that scenario has pushed scores of younger dark matter hunters in an intriguing new direction. What Feng and others propose is that dark matter consists not only of one particle, but of an entire catalogue. It's not one, I'll have to tell you a quick joke after this. All interacting with each other, a dark force that nothing in the regular universe can feel, except gravity. The components of the dark sector might even form their own atoms and molecules, opening up a whole new world of dark chemistry. Oh, well, okay. So, I'll make it correct. There's this wife, Liz, I'm making it politically correct. This wife is on the radio, and she knows her husband is driving to work along a particular freeway, and she hears a radio report. A lunatic is on the freeway, driving in the wrong lane, driving towards the traffic, take extreme care. So she gets the mobile phone, phones up her husband and says, "Look, honey, make sure you watch out for this lunatic driving the wrong way." And this person says, "Look, there's not just one, there's hundreds of people driving the wrong way." So that's the story. That has a really good joke then, but not been told well. You can probably tell it better. That's done the rounds of Australia 5 years ago, probably out 15 years ago in the United States. That might seem outlandish, but there's a good reason to consider the possibility. After all, the stuff we consider ordinary comprises a variable collection of particles. So no great leap of logic is needed to assume that the same holds true for dark matter. What's more, strange observations in recent years have hinted at the existence of dark forces and interaction of dark matter
may be more complex than wimp hunters believe. The first observation is that dark matter appears to be spread even more thinly within. This is what I'm talking about, the solar system anomaly is here. Perhaps they're talking about that. There is a fantastic graphic here. I don't know what the artist was on when they drew it. Oh, here's a classic wimp detector. You've got to have thousands of lines. I don't know what that is. Galaxies. Then the wimp model predicts something that can be explained. If dark matter particles exert a repulsive force on one another, pushing themselves apart. Oh, that even hurts myself, my head to think about that. Particle experiments on Earth have thrown up similarly suggestive anomalies. Most recently, in 2016, when researchers at the Nuclear Physics Lab in Hungary noticed that, well, there you go, Hungary, the superpower of nuclear research, obviously. Nuclear physics in Hungary is well ahead of Australia in nuclear research. Noticed that beryllium atoms decaying in a way that could be explained only if invoking a new force of nature. Well, obviously, everything else in the periodic table is explained, but you've picked up beryllium atoms. Now, beryllium is that one where you splatterlate, you introduce a proton into it, it smashes and produces neutrons, so decay. I don't understand. Claiming a dark matter, dark sector exists is all well and good. Thanks for dropping that into us. The Hungarians have come up with something mad. Okay. A dark sector exists is all well and good, but deciding how to populate it is a different story altogether. Here's a quote. We could guess a potentially infinite range of dark sectors, says Shrove at Harvey Mudd College. Harvey Mudd College, I'd love to work there, in California. Where are you? I'm from the Harvey Mudd College. Stop everything. Fortunately, we don't have to do that. What Feng, Shuof, and others have realized is that the search can be guided by hard data rather than theoretical guesswork, obviously. You mentioned them, it would be annoying if you were a theoretical guesser. If the dark sector is capable of exchanging messages with the regular universe, then those rare points of contact turn into portals that can shed light on the world on the other side. Wow. To be clear, you're not being clear, amazing. To be clear, we aren't talking about something you could drive a spacecraft through. Quote, we call portals a mathematical doorways, said Goran Jenyak of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory near Chicago. You can imagine, this is all like the bubble. Before a tech boom, a tech bubble, you get this weird language appearing in these portals. These doorways allow for particles capable of feeling the dark force to interact with particles of regular matter. The most promising type of portal would be a direct metamorphosis, a dark sector particle transforming into one in the standard model. Fortunately, the invisibility of the dark sector allows us to dramatically narrow down where such portals can arrive. The dark constituents must be chargeless, and as such, particles cannot transform into charged ones. Any go-betweens must be neutral particles. Well, that's interesting. I think the neutral kaon is something which is violated. They found up a neutral kaon, which is by far the most interesting now result. I think 2012 was when they found the Higgs boson, switched it on. Oh, there it is, the first 0% of the energy range. Oh, yep, we found it, but then it's all blank. But they found these I think they're kaons, neutral kaons, which are parody stuff. So let's see if they're focusing on this. Okay, so they must be neutral particles. They just say they must be neutral. The three standard models, particles, that stand the best chance of interacting with such dark mediators are photons. Okay, they're zero charge. And so-called vector portals, Higgs boson via scalar portal. So, yeah, photons are vector quantities. What you say? Well, you've got polarized glasses. Your polarized glasses have a matrix transformation to the light going in. So this is one of the most aggravating things. I've been in the QuestCon. I've been asked to sit in front of a polarization lab table, explain it. And I said, oh, you got to have vector physics for it. And they said, no, you can explain it with scalar. It's just bizarro. And neutrinos via the neutrino portal. Okay, that's what I like that. Scalars, vectors, and neutrinos. Okay. If new particles exist, these portals are our best chance of creating and detecting them, says David Curtin, theorist at the University of Toronto. All we have to do now is watch their every move. It could take a while, but the stakeout has already begun. The most promising of the three is perhaps the vector portal, which is photons, in which which process is designed to produce ordinary photons, could occasionally spit out a dark photon, their shadowy alter ego. Like a regular photon, such a particle would be extremely gregarious. What? It would interact with anything that has electrical charge. The strength of the interaction would also be reasonably large. I mean, there's lots of places to look for it, and we stand a good chance of seeing it there. Moreover, a dark photon doesn't necessarily have to be perfectly analogous to a regular photon. It's just a proxy for all manner of vector bosons, a class of particles which the photons begins. They could form part of the dark sector. It's one of the long list of possibilities, said Natalia Toro, the Stanford University in California, Porto. Toro performs experiments at the Jefferson National Accelerator Facility in Virginia that's been attempting to flush out dark photons for years. They fire a high density of beam of electrons at fixed targets to generate photons in a hope that very occasionally they'll produce a dark photon too, identifiable by a telltale decay. Others, including Shuv, have looked for evidence of the dark photon by visiting decade-old data. Oh my God, I'd love to have a job like this. From the Bar experiment at SLAC Accelerator in California, which smashed electrons and the antimatter counterparts together until 2008. I can't believe that SLAC is still going. I think they've closed down. Although the efforts have become empty-handed so far, the search has just stepped up a gear. The more intense your beam, the more photons to produce, the greater your chance of making a dark one. And those odds that several new higher intensity beams are hoping to exploit, including the heavy photon search at Jefferson Lab and the dark light at the SLAC accelerator. They're not really going to. So I produce a photon. A dark photon would have to travel at the speed of light, but then it decay into what? Please tell me more. As of last month, there's also the PADMI experiment outside Rome. I could almost say PADMI sounds Italian. It's a very lively area, said Toro, but the truth is we're really just getting started. What a fantastic career to be in. That was much was clear in March 2017 when the entire field came together at the behest of the US Department of Energy, which is eager to find out how to get the biggest bang for its buck in the pursuit of dark matter, i.e. we're going to cut the bejesus out of you. There was no shortage of proposals for experiments aimed at rooting out dark photons. Amongst the most ambitious pictures, however, was the one touting a new detector at the Large Hadron Collider, which you'd want because they're dead in the water near Geneva, Switzerland. Instead of using photons to bridge between the two worlds, Curtin and his team wanted to use a different portal, Spy on the Higgs. God, that almost makes me sick. I don't know how many Higgs they're making, but they're making very few. They're making something. You'd be lucky in 1 in a trillion Higgs. The Higgs boson and its associated energy field are famous for giving other fundamental particles their masses. I think they're just the field is. The boson is actually. The actual particle is an excitation of the field, as far as I understand. In a dark sector populated by massive particles, it makes sense to think of them getting their mass from a dark equivalent. Okay, I think that's actually quite logical. Curtin says the best way to properly explore the Higgs portal is to produce lots of Higgs bosons, and the only place we can do that is our most powerful atom smashers. Indeed, Curtin reckons that the LHC might have been producing dark Higgs all along, whereas the regular Higgs falls apart before it can escape the detectors. The dark Higgs tends to avoid interaction, which means it's long-lived enough to get away scot-free. Mm-hmm. We already know that such long-lived particles exist, so there's no reason to think new particles from the dark sector won't also travel a great distance before they came. The long-lived particles we find might be the Higgs, dark Higgs, and another kind of particle from the dark Higgs sector. Then it interacts with the dark Higgs, says Curtin. The only way to know, to find out the long-lived particles is to study their properties. That might seem a quixotic task. After all, in theory, these particles could decay anywhere, but cosmological observations place a limit on how long they can last, roughly 0.1 seconds. Oh, God, that's the distance of the Earth. What's, that's 30,000 kilometres. That's a huge distance. The Earth is only 12,000 kilometres away. That's a huge distance, 0.1 seconds. So the trick is to cover a sufficiently large area around the LHC to catch them, regardless of the direction of travel to the point of collision. 0.1 seconds. Are we talking about... 1 second light travels 300,000 kilometres, you know, almost up to the beam. In 0.1 second, it travels 30,000 kilometres, which is roughly 3 Earth widths. What the heck are they doing? Wow, that's a big grant. This is precisely why Curtin and his colleagues have proposed a new detector, LHC, to catch them, the Methuselah. Oh, God. After Methuselah, the biblical character who lived to ripe age of 969. It would be essentially amount to a huge barn above the beam line with detectors hanging from the ceiling to track any particles that make it thus far. The cost would be about $50 million. Methuselah wouldn't be cheap, but Curtin says it will be ready in 2026, when LHC is producing at least 10 times more Higgs boson than it does now. This is our best chance of seeing long-lived particles, including the dark Higgs. And I think there's probably other long-lived particles which you'll probably see. I think that's probably a good use of money. Methuselah might also shed light on a dark, third dark particle provided by neutrinos. As its smallest, lightest, and least sociable of known particles, neutrinos may seem uninteresting. In reality, though, they are bursting with mysteries. Not only are they three types of neutrinos somehow capable of transforming into another one at will, no, we know exactly how they transform, bucko, a process that's still not completely understood, but their masses are incredibly light for no good reason. Oh, their masses are incredibly light for no good reason. Yeah, that's okay. Just last week talked about sterile neutrino. To explain these mysteries, physicists have invented a heavier form of fourth sterile neutrino that would be even harder to spot than the other three. Such particles all have the hallmarks of dark matter mediator, one capable of travelling through the neutrino portal to transform into regular matter. Now, this is probably a bit interesting. Obviously, where you've got a huge blank except one area which doesn't work, which is the neutrino mass. The trouble is, unlike the photon and the Higgs, neutrinos can only feel forces, not carry them. Yeah, well, they're not a vector gauge boson, are they? They're spin a half. That means, yet... Oh, God, that hurts my head. That means yet another particle would be needed to allow particles of dark matter to interact with sterile neutrinos. Oh, my God, Father. That makes things more complicated, says Miguel Escuda of the University of Valencia, Spain, and probably explains why the neutrino portal is largely gone under the radar. Oh, this almost hurts my head to read this. Only in the past couple of years have people like Escuda began to explore scenarios in which dark sector talks to us through sterile neutrinos. Oh my God, Father. The models they have come up with are promising but dependent on confirmed discovery of the sterile neutrinos. Several experiments are currently on the hunt, and hints of one coming in from the experiment called the Mini Boonie at Fermilab grabbed headlines earlier this year. But for Escuda, It's premature even to suspect it could be the emissary of the shadowy world we seek. I think the story is that their results were just junk. If we ever do start reliably producing such things, however, they will bring exciting new leads in our long quest to identify dark matter. This is the information poor article. If the dark photon is we identify decays invisibly, for example, meaning it decays into dark matter, it would tell us dark matter is lighter than a dark photon. Suddenly, we would know that dark matter is lighter than something that would rule out 99.9% of our theories. It's impossible to say which of any of the portals will reveal the dark sector. In fact, to ask the question is to miss the point, says Flip Tendo of University of California, Riverside. Quote, the reason we are squeamish to say these are the best candidates is because we no longer think that way. This generation is not driven by the same sense of certainty of the previous generations, gripped as they were by supersymmetry fever and the rush to find wimps. We're a bit humbler, says Tanita. We focus more on experiments we can do to find something that will guide us. I.e. that they're dead in the water. I think no one's going to fund them. Ever. If you had to be at funding between someone who could clean up nuclear waste or look for dark matter, what would you do? Or a tsunami. This is other things. I don't know what the world is doing. Why we don't have the UN doesn't place tsunami, take over tsunami work. Because it's just pointless. Japan's got excellent tsunami warnings, whereas Indonesia can't organise it. Okay, so this is just my general thoughts on the places. The Missing City on the Plains. This is a new article. Following the footsteps of an ill-fated conquistador, archaeologists may have unearthed one of the America's biggest pre-Columbian settlements. Daniel Carson's report. Same person. So this is the second article. So it could be incredibly flowery English to start off with. Okay. In June 1601, Juan de Onta, conquistador and governor of the fledgling colony of New Mexico, marched eastward in search of Cuivia, a fabled land of gold thought to lie near the undiscovered coast. He found no treasure and no ocean. But according to Spanish records, Onate's expedition did turn up an intriguing discovery, one whose true significance is just coming to light. See, this is where the flowery English really works. You've got a conquistador, everyone knows who they are, not everyone knows what dark matter is, and I think this works, whereas flowery language doesn't work where you've got sort of science hidden in various ways. Its testimony is given on their return. Anarte's soldiers describe their journeys across what is now the U.S. state of Texas. How? How could they be in Mexico if they were in Texas? I wonder how that happened. Oklahoma and Kansas. Oh, how is that? That's America. How is that Mexico? They spoke of grasses so high that in many places they hid the horse. Apache horse riding vast herds of monstrous bison. I just didn't think horses got up. 1601. Okay, Apache's got horses by that quickly. They were really quick. Their friendly encounters with a tribe they called the Escanexques. Then the Spanish recounted how they were led to a settlement of people they called the Realdos, so large that it would have taken 2 days to walk across it. Oh, this is a settlement, not the people. They called it Esandola and reckoned it was the home to some 20,000 people. Okay. Okay, that's like the size of the first three villages up in Glenbrook. Okay, scholars have long been skeptical about Etazonda. Conquistadors were notorious for embroidering their tails to impress the Spanish authorities, unlike these people. And many believe that the people of the Great Plains lived in small, scattered settlements, not in sprawling proto-cities. now, fresh translations of the Psalter's Testimonies have led one archaeologist to claim he has found Etzazona, if true, and if it is really an extensive, as Onat reported, it would only shake up our picture of how the people of the Great Plains lived before the Europeans arrived. It would, but before they were using horses. I just can't. That blows my mind. It would also remind us that the remains of large, socially complex settlements can hide in plain sight. Or, if we never thought of it, why we want to be reminded, that's a bit confusing. Modern attempts to find Etzazona have relied on enigmatic map drawn by a man called Miguel. He is thought to have come from Cuiva, but captured by the Escans as a boy. He's taken prisoner by Onat's men as they return from Etzazona in 1601, during a day-long skirmish with the Escanses, who had turned on them. He was later taken to Mexico City, where he gave testimony and sketched the landscape. The first attempt to find the place depicted in the Miguel map came in 1982, but it led nowhere. 4 years later, Susan Vick, an anthropologist at the University of Oklahoma, published a breakthrough. She realized a portion of the map that dealt with the Great Plains depicts north to the left rather than to the top, and figured out that one settlement of Onat's expedition reached was either along the Wenatchee River in southern Kansas, or probably the Beaver Creek near the border of Oklahoma and Kansas. This is all Mexico, guys. How did this become American? Quote, with the information available to this point, it is not really possible to separate them as points of destination, Vic wrote. Since then, fresh leads have come to light. In 2013, a group of historians, that's 1982. Okay, so this is a story a long time in the making. This is great for New Scientists. They're really good at this one. Since then, fresh leads have come to light. In 2013, a group of historians and linguists led by Jerry Caddock, the University of California, Berkeley, published new translations of documents associated with the Onat's expedition, the official account written by one of the friars who traveled, and the testimonies of five soldiers questioned in Mexico City in 1602. What? This has just got full of life. I love friars and soldiers, conquistadors going up. They also posted a full-color scan of the original Miguel map, including corrections to the names of some of the settlements. That was enough to pique the interest of Donald Blacksey, an archaeologist at Wichita State University in Kansas. Blacksey had previously been involved in an attempt to retrace the route of Francisco Vasquez de Corondo, who led the first Spanish expedition to the Great Plains in the 1540s. Wow. As such, he has a keen appreciation of the pitfalls of using historical accounts to find archaeological sites. Quote, you have to read carefully, he says. But new translation convinced him to follow the footsteps of that. I was so impressed, says Blacksley. Earlier versions were a bit murky, but this was so vivid. I thought, wow, I can almost picture the places. Before long, Blakey was out in the fields, in the woods, around the confluence of the Arkansas and Want River, not far from Arkansas City in South Kansas, comparing the map with the land maps described in the documents, with the lie in the land as it is today. Can you imagine him in a pickup? Okay. His explorations brought him to one of the two swathes of land that Vic had identified. Are described in the documents that lie off the land and as it is today. Explorations brought him to one of the two swathes of land that Vinnick had identified 20 years early. Scattered archaeological
Evidence of habitation, such as pottery arrowheads, had been found there since as early as the 1950s. Now he's walking in the footsteps of an Ate, matching descriptions of his journey with landmarks on the ground. Quote, "If you go there and spend time in the landscape, things begin to fall into place," says Blakesley. Sure enough, he found the spot where he thinks the Spanish had to swing away to the east so that their ox carts wouldn't get stuck in the rough ground. And the hill from which they first saw Regos across the river. He even located what he suspects is the rocky ravine from which the Escoignets attacked Anat's party as they sought to begin their journey home. Quote, "Nobody had ever looked for it before," says Blakely, "but the accounts are very specific. And once you scour the landscape, you see there's only one ravine that could have hidden thousands of people." Like, thousands of people. My God, that's amazing. In the spring of 2015, having secured permission for the lander, Blakely drafted in archaeologists from the National Park Service at the Kansas Historical Society. They used remote sensing to search below the ground for evidence of habitation, and they struck gold. Well, not quite. What they found was evidence of clusters of houses surrounded by gardens, which fits nicely with the eyewitness testimonies described by Anate and his men. As Eo de Arta, a soldier on the expedition, reported, the houses were all made of poles stuck into the ground, covered with straw, and closed up on top like tents, separated by a series of small fields of corn, beans, and squash. Archaeologists could only see the large storage pits described by Anate and his men, so could also see, not to mention pottery and stone shards, thought to be debris from manufacturing of tools to butcher games and scrape hides. Quote, "It was clearly a well-populated area," says Vehik. "There's no doubt about that. What isn't clear," she says, "is whether the artifacts and archaeologists and the amateurs have uncovered an area over the decades are from people who were living there all at the same time, or a result of small groups moving around over time." For Blakely, the clincher came in the shape of Iron Shot. He had taken a group of volunteers armed with metal detectors down a rocky lined ravine he had identified as the spot where the battle took place. Just as everyone was thinking about packing up, Lando's son dug up an iron ball roughly the size of a marble. It was pockmarked and in a way that convinced Blakely it had been fired from a Spanish gun. And he had found it in the Spanish. He also found a Spanish horseshoe nail. "We've definitely found the site of the battle," he says. Blakely is a similarly bullish about having found Etzanoa. Quote, "It's obvious that at this point," he says, and he isn't alone. Scott Ottman, an anthropologist at the University of Colorado Boulder, who spent a couple of weeks at the site around Arkansas City, is satisfied that the details of the accounts of Anat's expedition checks out with what they're finding on the ground. "Everything I've seen of the landscape and archaeology is inconsistent with Anate's descriptions," he says. "I'm convinced." Robert Horde, an archaeologist at Kansas Historical Society, is more cautious. They like this. They always do this sort of really set piece of New Scientist. "I think it's plausible that the Walnut River Valley site is a Noah. It's also plausible that they are not, and they are the result of long occupation of smaller groups or people," he says. "I would need firm evidence of Spanish contact with the indigenous people. Ideally, that would come as a sort of quantitative metallurgical evaluation to unambiguously determine the iron shot and the horseshoe nail really are Spanish." If Blakely is right, though, the implications are profound. It would make Enzo the second largest prehistoric settlement ever found in North America after Chaoxia, a city of at least 20,000 people in the modern-day Illinois. The Mississippi Metropolis list. I remember reading about that. We'll go back and see if we can read that. Further reshaping our understanding of how people of the Great Plains lived in the period before Spanish arrived. The conventional picture is that of a vast empty space populated by nomadic tribes following bison herds. Etzanoa tells a different story. that at least some tribes settled in large towns, raised crops, made pottery, and processed bison on a huge scale. Quote, I'm not sure if I'd call it an urban lifestyle, says Ottman, but I do think that the scale of the place and the extent to which it requires political organisation is greater than we might have imagined. Ottman agrees, if we can show that there were thousands of people living and working together, growing huge amounts of food for which they carefully planned planting, harvesting, storage and redistribution, he says, we have to consider that the people of the Great Plains created a more complex social organisation than anyone knew. He also points out that they did so in a region that is nowhere near as promising as the floodplains on which Chacua rose and fell. It was famously referred to as the Great American Desert by the Europeans, says Horde. That was overstatement, but to find a large indigenous community in this difficult environment is testimony to the people living there. Just as intriguing is that, as far as we know, the Etzonians built their society without any monumental architecture. Chauca had a collection of giant mounds in the centre, sculpted from earth and used for ceremony, cementing the hierarchy through which the society was governed. But Edzo doesn't appear to have anything of the sort. Similar to the Carthage city, there's a lot of cities, urban, this is me speaking, there's a lot of urban archaeologies where this is missing, and there's commentary about it. How did these people accomplish this level of social organisation without monuments and the inequality they typically indicate? Well, Maite, that's really interesting, that monuments signify inequality. Bakshi and his colleagues will seek answers to the question next year, when they plan to carry out more extensive excavations. The dream scenario, he says, is to find some sort of communal structure. If a community was large as described, it's going to have some sort of public architecture, says Bakshi. In the meantime, the Wichita people, many of whom live nearby Oklahoma, are watching with interest. Thought to be descendants of the Etzanonians, they have been involved from the beginning of the excavations. Current residents of Arkansas City have also embraced the discovery of by setting up the Etzanoa Conservancy, a non-profit organization that aims to preserve, study the sites, many of which lie in their own backyards. It's early days, but plans are afoot to create a visitor centre and ultimately apply for UNESCO World Heritage status. Oh my god, it's getting out of hand. That would put Edzone on par with some of the world's most spectacular archaeological sites. Oh god, except it's just fields as far as I can. From the museums at Lepus Magna in Libya, the ancient temples of Angora, Wat and Cambodia. That might seem like a stretch to some, given how few traces of the thatched, beehive-shaped houses that Edzone left behind. But Ottman, therein lies an important lesson. Edzonia is not visually compelling in the same way as some of the world's most famous archaeological sites. But the human history it conveys is just as interesting, he says. There's a tendency to equate a degree to which sites are preserved with social development of the people who live there, he says. But big and well-organized communities don't always leave behind an obvious archaeological record. To me, that raises the question of how many other cases there are out there like this. There's a fair distance across the United States. There's a map showing there. And it's the Walnut River runs, so Arkansas is between the Arkansas River and the Walnut River. There's a confluence just outside Arkansas, and then Arkansas, and then wow, it's Arkansas. So Arkansas City doesn't seem all that big to me. In fact, it looks actually rather small. Okay, the Mississippian metropolis in southern Illinois, just beyond the urban sprawl of East St. Louis, the flat plains give rise to a big grassy knoll. This is the other one. Okay, this is the Chacotia. That marks the center of North America's first city. Chacolia, is, as it's known, began in the 9th century as a small collection of villages inhabited by the Mississippian people. At its peak, 200 years later, it was home to as many as 20,000 people, and it was quite a sight. a 30-metre-high terrace structure hewn from clay-heavy soils, overlooked the Grand Plaza, outside which people lived in thatched huts and scattered across the landscape. Analysis of the bones and teeth from the site suggests that people came from Chikoa from far afield. What brought them there? Some archaeologists think that it was down to politics and economics. A powerful leader created a new form of governance, and the people flocked to take advantage of the urban life and made it possible. Oh, that's interesting to say it that way. Others argue the city emergence was a result of religious revival, perhaps inspired by the star that went supernova in 1054 and lit up the night sky for almost a month. Either way, it didn't last long. Chakoa seems to have been abandoned by the middle of the 14th century, just before the Europeans came. In fact, that it existed at all shows Native Americans didn't always live nomadic lives, scattered across the plains in small groups. But it was an outlier, the only known example of urban living in North America before the Europeans arrived. Hence why people are excited by the recent discovery of what seems to be a similarly sized settlement in southern Arkansas. There we go. Culture, the Gift of Reading. There's a whole series of little books which I won't read through. And this is a book, so I'm missing a large amount of culture, and Living the Hive Life. Where Unlocking the Secret of Bees finds Sandrine Kirstmont. Sorry, pronunciation. It's this book called The Honey Factory, The Inside Ingenious World of Bees by Jürgen Tulz and Dietrich Steen by Black Incorporated. If it wasn't, and again, I've sort of just noted this, that the first word is fully capitalised. This is, I don't know, what's going on? I've only just seen this. Well, the first two words are fully capitalised. If it wasn't for the honey and the fragrant, versatile wax, we would probably steer well clear of bees. Early humans are thought to have discovered the delights of wild honey some 2 million years ago, with bee domestication dating from 9,000 years in what is now Turkey and Northern Africa. Initially, the results was a lot of stings and a destroyed nest, but keeping of bees evolved with advantages for both parties. So claimed the author, The Honey Factory. Jürgen Tulz and a bee researcher at the University of Wolfsburg in Germany, and Dietrich Steen, a beekeeper for over 20 years. They have joined forces to write a fascinating book that explores hive life from their roles of the honeycomb cells to bee communication. They show how 300 years of hive use has helped keepers hone the craft. Artificial chambers now allow us to extract bee products, but leave the colony relatively intact, for example. There are misconceptions to correct, says Tor and Steen. For example, the saying, busy as a bee, is far from the truth. The authors say honeybees are quite lazy and achieve great feats only by teamwork. Some experiments show foraging bees make 3 or 4 flights per day, but if 25,000 foragers bring 50 milligrams of nectar per trip, this makes an impressive 5 kilograms daily. Their famous waggle dance is misunderstood too. It has long been seen as a sophisticated form of communication used to convey the exact location of food to their hive mates. But recent work by Tulz and others showed that while the dance may tell the bees where to head, it isn't that precise. In fact, when food sources are remote, bees rely on experienced foragers to carry the scents of flowers they're seeking to guide them. Well, isn't that absolutely rip-snorting amazing? So I just hate this science, folk science. Fortunately, our understanding of bee behaviour is good enough for keepers to tweak it. In the wild, honeybees start a new colony by swarming then when their homes get overcrowded. To prevent this, keepers realise all they had to do was increase the size of the hive by adding a special box. New colonies can also be formed by removing the queen, thereby tricking the bees into rearing a new queen, which can be given its own hive. Over the past 40 years, though, domestication has faced new challenges. Vara mites, parasites that feast on the bee blood and the bee larvae. As the unwelcome guests reproduce, cripple more bees, the colony eventually collapses. The insects don't seem to have a way to tackle the mites, but beekeepers now know the power of formic acid produced by ants. Birds get ants to squirt it at them since it keeps parasites at bay. Wow! Whoa, whoa, this is a... The same trick seems to work against the mites when formic acid vapour is spread through the hive. If they weren't domesticated, the honeybees might have evolved to protect themselves. Tuss and Steens tells us, they advise studying them in forests where they originate, as we know little about their lives in the wild and how they coexist and perhaps even cooperate with fungi, bacteria, arthropods, animals to share their hives. The rediscovery of wild bees may reveal a way to construct honey factories for the future that are more at the moment we can't imagine. They're right. Good news for us, but better for bees' survival strategies. So that's a really excellent thing. It's just, I like the folk science not being good. Okay, and hopefully I might be able to finish this magazine. Okay, how are we going? It's the world that has failed rainforests letters. The editors speak, of course. As Mary Menton and Philippe Manlez says, the policies of President Bolsonaro of Brazil may threaten the Amazon rainforest. But it is the global policy on carbon pricing that fails to protect the forest. The Human Development Report 2007-8 points out that if carbon dioxide emissions are priced at $20 per ton, a hectare of rainforest should be worth up to $15,000. Yet, it may be chopped down to grow soybeans and graze cattle for market value as little as $300 per hectare. The Prince of Wales has quoted Lord Stern calling this the greatest market failure in history. If we had a carbon tax on emissions and used it to pay for just 5% interest on the capital of stored carbon in the bank of the rainforest, and then a hectare undisturbed rainforest could earn $750 a year, and nobody would dream of cutting it down for beef and beans. Instead, we ask Bolsonaro to hold back from exploiting an asset that is gathering no reward, while other nations benefit from free contribution to climate stability represented by the Brazilian trees. That's actually quite a good thing. Okay, this is the second reply. So what I'll do, this is the next one's about the gravity wave. And I think the New Scientist was just completely flawed in terms of putting graphics. Didn't put graphics out to explain how weak the people, anti-gravitational wave people's arguments are. But let's listen to it. Michael Brooks' recent article on reports of gravity wave detection and the response from LIGO and Virgo teams raises a number of interesting questions. If, as Brooks reports, the residuals of the events labelled GW150914 were published for the sole purpose of illustration, what are the correct data sets and why has LIGO not made them public? If LIGO believes that our analysis of correlations between the residual noise and different detectors is incorrect, why have they not stated clearly where that we've made a mistake? If our calculations are correct, why does LIGO consider this statistically significant 80% correlation irrelevant for the interpretation of the observed signal? Despite LIGO's claims of openness, we haven't been able to identify members of the collaboration who can speak authoritatively and officially on LIGO's behalf. On matters of data analysis. We believe it would be useful for LIGO to identify some individual or groups of scientists to represent it with the aim of resolving the difference of interpretation in an appropriately professional manner. Oh, it's beautiful. I remember marvelling at the ability of gravity wave analysis to tell us not only that the squiggle represented the collision of two black holes, but their respective solar masses from half a dozen wobbles peaks standing out on a mushy background. I thought that was wonderful. Now Michael Brooks informs us that the experimentalists first calculated what they might expect to see, then subtracted that from what they actually saw, and made profound assumptions from that. I remain very confused and not a little disillusioned. Well, you've got to really read more than that. My general thing is that if you don't read the big books on gravity waves, you just stand back, go and read them. That's the thing I'd say. Guaranteed kiss. Okay, Valerie Jamison reports Florence Bell, an unsung physics of DNA pioneer. Valerie Jamison reports a real-life experience of women in physics in her article about why there are so few women in the field. The physicist Florence Bell would have agreed. Her PhD supervisor, William Astry, declared that there is an creative spark in a male that is absent from women, even though the latter do such marvelous conscious and thorough works after the spark has been struck. When Bell gave a presentation about her work at the Institute of Physics conference in Leeds in 1939, the local press reported under the stunned headline, "Women Scientist Explains." She would have wanted to be remembered, though, for helping to lay the foundations for one of the biggest scientific discoveries of the 20th century. Her PhD research included taking a very first successful X-ray diffraction images of DNA, which I thought that was someone else, wasn't it? Oh, I've forgotten. Oh, dear. Which helped pave for the later work of structure. Oh, it's Franklin's. Of Rosalind Franklin and Raymond Gosling. While most scientists at the time thought DNA was to be a boring molecule with little interest, Bell recognised that, in conjunction with proteins, it might play a important role in biology. Sadly, this promising work was brought to an abrupt end by the Second World War. She served in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force and then immigrated to the US and gave up science to raise her family. Her thesis has just been made available online at the University of Leeds. I nominated Rosalind Franklin for the $50 note. Alice Bell suggests that Dorothy Hodgins should be on the banknote of the new $50 note as a pioneer of the array of X-ray crystallography. I suggest that the most appropriate scientist to feature would be Rosalind Franklin. She was a vital member of the team that worked on DNA structure, but there's only one not to share a Nobel Prize simply because of her early death. This is an opportunity to give her the recognition she deserves, not to mention acting as a role model for female would-be scientists. Should I have to mention that DNA, the deoxy from the ribose, so deoxyribose, nucleic acid, the removing the oxygens makes it more oily. And so it's really, it makes it more water repulsive. DNA is slightly a bit more water repulsive, and so this is why when you have just isopropanol, which is again a bit more oily, the DNA moves up to it. It's quite interesting. Elon Musk's satellite plan is a great deal of garbage. Okay. The plan to put 4,425 satellites in orbits of Elon Musk's space internet seems impressive at first, but it's not just a financial cost that will be high. Does SpaceX plan to retrieve and recycle obsolete satellites? There is too much debris in orbit, as is. Simply shunting old satellites to different orbits is surely not going to be a long-term solution. Besides, if Musk lives to orbits with debris, he will make his own Mars plan more challenging. I think there's a little bit more story to it all, quite honestly. Space vehicles will find it harder to plot a safe path through the junk. As for all the manufacturing plans should be made to design stages to retrieve and recycle objects that enter at the end of useful life. Sports cards included. I would agree. The sports cards are just... Okay, here's another one. Robert Hill Leeds. Musk plans requiring keeping 4,425 working satellites in orbit. If each lasts an average of 5 years, the replacement rate would be 17 satellites per week. This would be several times the current total world launch rate for all purposes. It's just completely mad, mate. Polynesians could help us read Inca writing. Now, this is interesting. By Peter Ashby, Dundee, Angus, UK. Daniel Cousins discusses the possibility of Inca Kipchu might encode stories as well as numbers. I think you've got to think of the strings as a palm pilot. You know, it would say a few words, but if the culture's gone, if you pick up someone else's palm pilot, it's impossible to know. Apparently, the master navigators and peerless blue water sailors the Polynesians use is not caused to encode sailing instructions and have been used for modern trips in recreated voyaging canoes. It seems the Polynesians reached Central America and brought back sweet potatoes. These were ubiquitous when Europeans entered the Pacific and the Maori New Zealand had developed semi-temperature cultivars. So it seems entirely possible that the Polynesians picked up the ideas of knots from the Incas. As we know how to read knotted sailing instructions, can these be used to the idea of ki ipitu? It's also interesting that the Tongans have knitted baskets which encode the wave patterns to allow them to navigate around the place. Okay, next letter. Yes, electric car owners may feel entitled to drive. Rosemary Sharps asks whether the lack of pollution at the point of use of electrical cars makes their driver feel entitled to make more and longer trips. It is true with me. My mileage in the Nissan Leaf is greater than it was in my previous fossil fuel behemoth. I now make more trips to the recycling centre, but carrying the same volume. I drive to the local shops when they are cheaper than online deliveries. I joined a voluntary group that offers rides to the elderly. When disposing of my belongings online, I offer free delivery within Leaf's range. These are my total journeys. My Leaf is one of the oldest in the UK and needs to be charged every 80 kilometres. My godfather. Further, I am concerned at the prospect of 100% electric vehicles with acceleration faster than a racing car. On roads, let's pray for safer self-driving. This is actually a very nice person. More problems with economics than science. Features of economics that held Sam Edge to state that is not a science. That it's not a science. I found in much of the social sciences, particles, planets, animals, chemical reactions, and tectonic plates do not change their behaviour in response to new theories. That is a brilliant theme. That is, the human economics is the interaction between theory and science. Is beautiful. Humans do change in response to economic theories. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but there is no theory capable of predicting where those responses will take us. As far as economics goes, we are butterflies whose flapping triggers the storm. That's perhaps interesting. I like that. That's a really beautiful thing. I wish I could remember all these points. Things that make your brain tingle. This is the thing. This is music and certain mathematical equations. I get a tingle. Michael Marshall discusses the brain tingles as autonomous sensory meridian responses, ASMRs. It seems that these were what Vita Sackville-West, lover of her fellow writer Virginia Woolf, had in mind in her 1950s radio talk Walking Through Lees. As well as the sensation of the title, she mentioned the silky glide of the filing cabinet drawer and the roller bearings as putting on a fleshly iron shirt. She also mentioned sensations that have the opposite effect, such as the nasty feel of treading on granulated sugar on a tiled floor. Mm-hmm. Okay, closer contacts with brain waves. Jim Skeels from Toronto. Chelsea White reports people collaborating to play a game Tetris via electroencephalography, whatever it is, EEGs, caps to record brain signals, and transcranial magnetic stimulation caps to transmit. These seems rather cumbersome. I think it's a complete gawk. Why not try receivers closer to the brain? People wear dentures right against the roof of their mouth. One day, miniaturization and signal transmission advances in sensors would make it possible to use a tooth implant. Actually, quite a smart person. Okay, that's covered there. I'm not going to read from the archives, but ski slope catwalk. This is the last word. During the Winter Olympics, TV commentators said it's advantageous for ski jumpers to be light because they will travel further. Being light is seen as a disadvantage for slope-style snowboarders. What's the difference? What's the effect do snowboarders' baggy clothes have on performers? Would they do better with body-hugging ski suits? On downward slopes, a heavier skier or snowboarder will go faster than a lighter one because gravitational energy and kinetic energy are both proportional to mass. Yeah, as a scientist, I think, bam, bam, because they are both, will not go faster, he said. No, I think they mean will not go faster. Yeah, I really think you mean will not go faster. But in the air, a ski jumper enjoys lift. The lighter ski jumper, this may be overcome the disadvantages they experience on the slope. Oh no, that's really bad. The lighter ski jumpers do tend to fly further than heavier ones. During the descent of the ramp, a heavier skier has the advantage of air drag holding them back less than does the lighter skier. But the lighter skier has the advantage during flight. We are all familiar with the almost horizontal position skiers assume after launch. They do this because the lift force of the skis travelling through the air has a large upward component. Even the air drag has a slight upward element. The aerodynamic forces don't depend on the skier's mass, but the amount of downward acceleration does. Imagine a rectangular piece of paper and a book of equal area. Drop them, and both paper will float to the ground well left behind the book. Similarly, for carryable cross-sectional areas, the lighter skier's downward acceleration will be less than the heavier skier's. Having a large mass is great for overcoming drag, but having a small mass is great for allowing it to keep aloft in the air. Okay, that's better. That New South Wales person is so embarrassing. Unseamly seams. When I buy a new cotton t-shirt, the side seams are always straight and parallel. After a few washes, one piece of material seems to move relative to the other. It seems never to be parallel again. Why is this? If you look closely at the fabric of a t-shirt, you'll see that it is made up of thin vertical rows of ribbing from the front to the back to be aligned. The rows must be parallel. This is difficult to achieve. In the factory, multiple layers of fabric will be laid upon top of each other before cutting out the t-shirt pattern. So there's a high possibility that cuts will not fall exactly along the vertical rows. As a home sewer, I often choose t-shirt fabric for its softness and ease of wear, but it does require more care in cutting out stage. Okay. T-shirt fabric is often manufactured as a tube in which the bands of interlooped yarn run through the fabric in spiral rows of stitches. When the tube is slit open to make a flat piece of material, the rows of stitches may lie at a slight diagonal across the fabric. When the fabric is cut, this is a bit too hard, and sewn into a t-shirt. When washed, the stitch rows tend to straighten, resulting in the seam twist. I think I actually understand that. Okay, bit hard to me to get anything. A t-shirt material is knitted from a continuous thread, forming loops that interlink with rows above and below. The loops allow it to widen any directions while narrowing the direction at the right angles, giving it a nice stretchy t-shirt with a stable shape. It will stay like that until you wet the material and the threads relax. It is the drying that is crucial to maintain the shape. If you lay your t-shirt flat and pat it and pull it the right shape before leaving it to dry, it'll be fine. If you just chuck it over the line and hope for the best, you'll probably end up with a different shape. It can be rescued by reshaping while gently steaming an iron. So this is interesting. For each of these are different stories. This is the third one. Beer belly is a peculiar form, usually male, of weight gain. Is there incredible evidence that beer is capable of producing a localized fat deposition? If not, what causes it? Beer is high in calories and is often consumed with high-calorie foods like chips. Okay, because beer is lower in alcohol than other alcoholic drinks, and because there is more cultural norm to drink large amounts in one sitting than, say, one beer, is usually the alcoholic drink from which most calories are taken, leading to accumulation of fat. So drinking beer, and not vodka for example, is associated with large bellies. It's not as much beer itself, it's how it's drunk. More men have beer bellies as the fat tends to gather there than men and women. In fact, women fat is deposited more evenly around the body. I think you've missed the point that your liver cirrhosis of the liver causes that beer belly. I think they've missed the point there. Okay, thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.